the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, thanks for coming to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. You'll notice I'm on the road today at my wife's office, a lovely setup here. I don't know if it's worse or better than the back office at my place, but it doesn't matter. So we got a very special guest today. Jeff Booth is joining me. Before we get started, though, as always, this show, as with all other episodes, brought to you by the mighty ShakePay, best place for Canadians to buy and sell, though you should never sell Bitcoin. So many things going on there now. Recently, they just added the Shake Squads, where you and your buddies get together, you spend off your CAD balance, and you each get 42 sats for every purchase during the day. Not bad. Definitely got to run a contest with those totals pretty soon. Also, shaking sats, if you sign up with our promo code, CharlieBetaPeter, you can shake your phone every day up to 1,000 sats after 365 days, which is dope. They get the cashback Visa card as well, where you spend off your CAD balance. It's 2% back on the first 5,000, 1% after that, all Satoshis, of course. And then finally, the Shake Paid, which is somehow still going on. You use your Shaking Sats card or your Sats Back card. They just comp you the purchase in Bitcoin, which is wicked. I just had one comp the other day for like $4. I got to talk to those guys because I spend a lot more than $4 on there sometimes and I don't get comped, but a story for another time. Also, of course, brought to you by our friends at Ledin. Now, this is an ad read I've never done, so I'm going to do my best here. I'm winging it a little bit. They got a couple of services that we use. One is the Bitcoin interest savings account. So you put in your Bitcoin. There's different tiers. So if you have up to 0.2 Bitcoin, for example, you get a certain amount of interest all in Bitcoin, accumulates every day, paid to you at the end of the month. They also have the B2X loan. If you feel good about where the price of Bitcoin is and maybe where it's going more specifically, you can put your money in there and double your Bitcoin stash. Make sure you keep your collateral up to date and pull it out. If you can't, of course, you should always pull out. They got a bunch of other stuff going on there too. The Bitcoin-backed mortgages obviously just became a pretty big feature for them, available in Ontario and a few other jurisdictions. So make sure you check if you're looking for a mortgage. And then finally, you can take a fiat loan if you give them your Bitcoin as collateral. So if you don't want to sell, avoid some tax events, whatever, you're crunched for cash, use these guys. Give them a shot. We like them. And during all these other DeFi blowups, they haven't had any problems, which is great. So that being said, friends, let's bring in our guest. Jeff is here. He's a man about town. He's been traveling quite a bit. We were talking before the show. He's barely back in the door here on the West Coast. Man, thanks for coming on. It's good to see you. How's things?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Joey. Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely, man. So we typically ask when we get guests, Jeff, for questions to talk to the guests about what they're up to, all these things. I got tons for you today, which has been outstanding, but we should start with a little bit of your story. For people who don't know, I'm not sure how you wouldn't know by now, but who are you? How did you get into Bitcoin? And I want to hear, my friend, a little bit about your big deflation thesis. Let's get after it.
Yeah, it's all connected. So I'm a technology entrepreneur since early or mid-90s, kind of late or mid to late 90s, technology entrepreneur, building businesses on top of with technology and really kind of understanding what that would do, what technology would do to our lives or for our lives. And I couldn't understand. And so today I sit on the boards of, I guess, now 8 different technology companies, some of those which I would own a majority stake, some of which I'm just a chairman of the board and investor in. And they span a range of different industries. But generally, where technology can improve our lives, where I love the founder's vision, and where I think I can help. And that whole drive through technology and building companies through this space and seeing kind of wins, losses, how thin the line is between complete failure and success, and people's egos changing across that spectrum and everything else, and kind of some of the mistakes, a whole bunch of mistakes I made along the journey as well, give me a viewpoint for kind of what technology is doing and where it's going. And I couldn't understand, and that's where it's connected to Bitcoin. I couldn't understand why it was that technology was supposed to free our time and make prices go down. Yet our financial system was designed the exactly opposite way. And it was supposed to make prices go up forever. And so that that curiosity led me on a journey. I was probably talking about this issue for 10 years prior to writing the book, and friends would probably get frustrated with me talking about this issue because it was my campfire talk all the time, my drunk talk all the time. And when I realized how bad this was, kind of, or what this looked like, two different systems colliding against each other, and what it meant for the existing system, I decided to write the book, The Price of Tomorrow. And I wrote that primarily because I realized what my kids would grow up in if this wasn't addressed, because the society was going through a phase change, and most of society was caught in the old model, unable to see the phase change because they were measuring the system from the system. And so I wrote that book essentially painting a picture of what would happen to society as we moved along this path. And that book came out in, I guess, December of 2019. And it's predicted everything that's happened, essentially.
Yeah, it's you've been really vindicated. I don't know if you got any shit from, maybe you got some shit from your friends around the campfire. I've heard a lot of, you know, interesting topics around a campfire after a few beers. Deflation, sir, not one of them. But maybe I'll bring that one around this summer when I head to the cottage in a few weeks. Have you?
Actually think about that, just because it's so natural that we don't actually even question it. So no. When I say technology is deflationary, it's driving productivity. And if the technology works and we use it, we only use it because it makes our lives better and it brings prices down. So that seems, even what you're doing right now. Yep. Nod your head. Right. And then everybody goes straight back from that concept to, oh yeah, but my house should go up forever and every other price should go up forever from the world they live in. And what they don't realize by doing that is they're actually giving the system more power over them. They're concentrating that break, because one thing should, nature should be working one way, but that concentration of all of the wealth, because it presupposes somebody should make a rule and be able to print money to be able to transfer the broad-based abundance that should be coming to society to a few people. That's what it really says. But nobody, but they just, okay, yep. And they live in this world where they believe in two things that are diametrically opposed.
So, okay, first of all, great start here. Let's pull on that thread a little bit. These two things, Jeff, that we should be experiencing a easier life as time goes on, thanks to technology, and the value of everything should continue to go up thanks to, you know, fiat principles. This is quite a conjecture. And so how do you explain to people, how do you breach that membrane with them? Because like you said, you know, and I was doing it as well just now, just nodding along. I think you're right. And I think a lot of people would think you're right if you phrase it to them that way. But obviously, it's not getting through to many, many people. People are still, and I count myself among these folks as well, buying houses, thinking that the house can never go down in value over a long enough time horizon, buying stocks, thinking they can never go down in value over a long enough time horizon, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you make that, connection for them? What's the, you know, what's your approach? What's worked for you?
So I think that's why the book had such a profound, I think actually it's also why it was picked up in Bitcoin circles, because it gave a way to talk about Bitcoin and actually what Bitcoin does from a fundamental understanding of economics that was different than people's existing understanding of economics. Because what we're really saying is the only reason prices go up is an unnatural response from people deciding to how much money they can manipulate. It is the only reason. Prices should be falling, but we've never lived in a market before what's happening with Bitcoin that could happen. and we can go into that at a deeper level, but we've never lived in it. And so we will always, I mean, society in general will, today I'll back up. So today at 126% debt to GDP in the US, there is no mathematical way for the US to do quantitative tightening for a long time without collapsing the global economy. And if they do, so that what that means is you're going to have credit crises and credit unwinds and bankruptcies everywhere and mass unemployment and house prices falling. If they continue to tighten, they won't, but if they continue to tighten and it starts around the world, other places first, and it comes into the US, and every single bank fails, every single institution fails, all of the world that we live on, all of our belief structure on top of that system, that is just that belief structure only exists because we've granted authority to people to press a button and destroy our wages, right? That entire belief structure in the world we live in collapses. If they actually go through and quantitative tightening for any length of time. So what would happen to society? What would just happen to you, your neighbor? What would happen if that actually happened and all house prices were falling, all banks were failing, you went to the bank and knocked on the door to get your money and the money wasn't there because it was a credit note that exploded with somebody else's counterparty risk. What would happen is you would rise up and you would march on the street and probably turn to violence. And before that happened, a different government or a party in that government would say, the central bank would be part of the government now. It wouldn't be an independent organization, and it would be your printing, right? Before that happened, or kind of as that happened. And what that says to you is we will always, as society, kick the can down the road. We want to listen to somebody who's going to lie to us and say, I'm going to give you more than you can actually get through an economic, and by doing so, I'm going to socialize losses and pretend I'm giving you something, but actually pick your pocket more and your living standards are going to go down. And out of that equation, by socializing those losses or manipulating money, you drive a massive wealth divide and you drive a centralization of power. And as you drive that centralization of power, you remove the free market. And the same thing that created the wealth divide, which was the manipulation of money in the first place, you pretend you can solve it by destroying the free market. So that's where we are in this cycle. And there's only door one and door two, manipulate money or don't manipulate money. And they both have massive dramatic consequences because it's not the free market. And so Bitcoin provides a path, a door three from the pain of those two doors.
So you said a couple of things there that I want to dive into a little bit. I'm kind of partial to this quote. I think I heard it from Doomberg on Twitter, but I'm sure it's not his or theirs, that even the most advanced civilized society is only 9 missed meals away from complete chaos.
Yep.
Do you think that there's going to be something before the 9 missed meals that really forces this uprising you're talking about? I ask because, you know, you're seeing already a lot of malcontent, discontent in modern economies, whether it's, you know, something as small as you and I talking about this on a live stream or the farmers in the Netherlands or, you know, whatever. There's obviously a protest here in the wintertime as well. You know, what is the breaking point before those 9 meals? Is there one, you think? What's the most likely candidate?
Yeah, so this is a complex question because people are, again, most of your time will be worried about your system. Maybe not you, and because you understand Bitcoin, but most of society's time is actually in that system that's getting worse and worse. And what I said is structurally has to get worse. I'll walk through some of the things I expect to happen, but structurally have to get worse all over the world, and are looking through that lens. And as people are rising up, trying to fight the system, what they don't actually realize is actually they're giving the system more power. As they're dividing society all over the world, they're actually giving the system more power. You can't change a face on that system and then think it's going to change because it's money itself that's broken. And money itself that's broken. So no political party could actually change what we're talking about as a structural level around the world. And political parties could be more pro Bitcoin and drive innovation on top of it and a free market on top of it and actually do a lot for their citizens. But the structure of the existing world is going to unwind, and that has massive consequences. So all of those people that you see rising up all over the world, it's not just in it like, look at them, right? All Italy now, you said Netherlands, if you look all over the world, look in Africa, and if you look in Venezuela, and if you look at Colombia, if you look everywhere, it's happening. And that's just, and we think it's these isolated events and we're safe here at home, and we're no safer at home. This is expanding around the world, and chaos is, winter is coming. I often think, what if those people that were marching against the governments all over just bought Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Every time if they just did that, the transition would be a lot smoother, because they each person doing that, they're actually building a network that's strong, a bridge to the other side that's stronger, and they're actually removing that power that is controlling them and driving the prices up and through that structure.
The other thing you said that I'm curious about is this idea that central banks are, you know, separate entities from governments, and in a crisis situation, they would no longer maintain that veil. Do you really think that at the moment that there's a case to be made that the Federal Reserve is truly arm's length from the United States government, from the White House? Or do you think that that central bank, along with other central banks around the world, are really just extensions of government policy catering to the whims of, you know, the Democratic majority? What do you think?
Yeah, they try to be independent, and then in time they lose their independence. And throughout history, it looks exactly the same. And why is because we demand it. Society demands they lose their independence. Imagine 30% unemployment and bankruptcies in the U.S. and house prices at a third of what they are now, and everything falling, banks failing. What would people ask? What would people do? Right. And in that question, and that's where people, I think so many people are confused by this, because they're measuring a system from the system that's creating the information, misinformation, is they don't understand how people say they'll do one thing and then do another given different circumstances. So we believe what we're capable of and what we will do all the time, what we'll react to, but under different circumstances we react totally different than we think. So if you have manipulation or misinformation in your money supply, and your entire world is set up with that misinformation and money or manipulation in money, then you'll see the worst of humanity emerge. And those people won't know. You have an error code in money, and the worst in us shows up. Because at the end of the day, how we think about the world, when actually push comes to shove, if everything fell apart, we think about ourselves and our family first.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll ask you what I consider to be maybe a little bit of a loaded question here, just in the same vein. What's stopping people from migrating their money to Bitcoin, in your view? It seems to me that, you know, even the most, you know, even the most feverish naysayer has to at least admit that the thing has staying power. Whether the price is volatile or not is a different story. There's many discussions and viewpoints on price volatility in Bitcoin and generally monetization of a new asset. In your view, what's the big hurdle? Because it seems to me that there's one set of hurdles for some of the nations you mentioned, Africa, for example, and an entirely different set of hurdles for people in Canada, United States, and Europe. So what is the sticking point for these guys? What are they missing that, you know, you understand, I understand, people watching, listening, understand?
There's no one sticking point. There's a whole bunch. But I can tell you from many friends who don't own it yet, and really good friends who you would think, if they know me, really good friends, that they would understand it. You let go of a lie one finger at a time. and when your entire belief system is I live in a fair world, I live in a democracy, fair rules, rule of law, and it's hard to question that belief system when you realize that if you don't have a vote on inflation, and inflation is with the majority of government revenue, then you actually, your vote doesn't matter at all, right? And that means democracy and communism, capitalism, communism look like the same structure over time. They get closer and closer, but people believe they're fighting for an ideologue, free markets, rule of law, but laws, and they believe that because they've grown up in a system of rule of law where we haven't had the manipulation of money like that's happening today, unaware that at some point in the manipulation of money, the laws changed to support the manipulation of money. And it's really easy to see, yet people haven't connected the dots. You look at nations that have had high manipulation of money, and what does the government look like? Yet they can't see the same thing that's happening here and happening around the world, because we've lived in a safe structure for a long time. This is connected, Joey, to what has to happen. And unfortunately, what's happening right now, essentially, you can't print energy, right? Your paper units of money, your digital units of money, they can't respond to printing energy. So energy prices just keep going up. And it's not like we haven't had innovation in energy, right? Or that there's abundant energy everywhere. It's a matter of finding that energy and pricing it. So if you're creating 50% more monetary units, you can expect energy prices to rise in lockstep. And energy being one of the thing that drives every other price, you could expect a whole bunch of people to be confused by that contradiction, unaware that the rise of energy prices was the manipulation of money in the first place. So as that happens all around the world, US has effectively energy independence, or energy independence with Canada, and energy independence, mm-hmm. food independence. Japan does not, Euro does not, Europe does not. And so what that means is, and what a system that relies on one currency for control over the rest of currencies, that now gets into a place where they have to manipulate their currency for, effectively what that means is you have to, your gain, your success is determined by somebody else's failure. Right. So the negative externality of your actions, it's not a fair market. And so the negative externality of the US system was South America, Central South America, and Africa. And that allowed us, or in Canada too, to live in this system that we look at those nations, we say, look at those Ponzi nations and look at those terrible dictators and everything else. And it's a structure, it's a design of the existing system. Well, that the negative externality now to protect the core is moving to Japan and the EU. So if the US continues to tighten, Japan is going to break and drive through hyperinflation, and it'll look like 100 times worse than the Lehman crisis as it cascades across the world. Same for Europe. And what that means is Germany is going to protect its core and blame Portugal, Spain, Italy. And whether the politicians that are elected right now believe, no, we're going to keep this together. They might believe that, and society might believe that, but what will happen, because we can't predict our actions and different people are going to march down the street or elect somebody new to be able to protect the core. And so that's what, so it turns into every country, every man for themselves, every man, woman for themselves, and you, and society breaks down, that trust breaks down across the globe. I'm painting a really ugly picture, but unfortunately, that ugly picture, in fact, it ties into why I care so much about Bitcoin. I believe it to be the only path out of this, without major war.
Do you, I know this is a big question, but since you kind of touched on it, you mentioned two things that I think are maybe something I could string together in one question. So I'll give it a go. You mentioned that democracy, as manipulation of currencies continues and accelerates, it blurs the line between that form of government, you know, which is, I guess, desirable for most people, and other forms of government, which in the past have been viewed as less than desirable, let's say. With that in mind, and also what you mentioned about the euro and the eurozone sort of now facing, I think, you know, really looking off the cliff, to put it lightly. What do you think the future of that region looks like, both politically and from a monetary point of view? I think euro this morning was, I think it was less than $1.02 or less than $1.03, yeah. Right? So you're approaching euro dollar parity for the first time in a long time. What are your views on that? Do you have a view on that euro area for the next 10 or 12 years?
I suspect it'll break apart long before that. It won't look this the same. A fiscal union like that can't work for a long time. It was broken by design, because it isn't a union like the U.S. It's a whole bunch of independent states with different leaders and different control structures tied to a fiscal union. It can't work for a long, long time. I'm not talking in time zones that it could work for 10 or 20 years. I'm talking for a long time. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay.
And by the way, the same thing is true for the U.S. The same thing is true for Canada. What happens when people kind of move inwards is they think about themselves first, and it's the problem of the other nation, or it's the problem, it's China's fault, right? In Germany, it'll be Greek, it'll be Italy's fault. We are not protecting those lazy Italians anymore. And that's what they'll say, right? Unaware of the entire structure of money that's created this whole thing in the first place. And in nations that have energy independence, right, or food independence, they will go inward. Why we go to war is it's really easy to believe a politician telling you it's somebody else's fault.
Yeah, I think we've seen that, maybe not just in wars, but also in election results in the last, 5, 6, 7 years all around the world. I want to ask you a question about your favorite topic, deflation. We got this from a listener and viewer, Julian. He's asking, I think, a good question about the cost of capital in a deflationary environment being too prohibitive to allow for true innovation. There's obviously, a number of negatives to fiat expansion, but one of the positives, it seems to me, has been that technology companies, for example, have been able to acquire capital very cheaply. And some of them have really done a lot of good work for the general population with that capital. So what are your views on that sort of investment structure in a deflationary environment? How would that work? I think you're probably the best guy to answer that, Jeff, between your Bitcoin tech knowledge, deflationary spin. I can't think of a better guy to answer that question.
So there's, and I think the question is again not understanding how startups come together, and not understanding how an idea percolates to be able to create value. And in any startup company I've founded or invested in, and I invest in them today, right? Lots today. They sell equity for a belief in a different future. And so right now you would ask, okay, well, if you believe Bitcoin is going to be the apex predator on money, and everything is going to fall against Bitcoin forever, I believe that. So why would I invest in these companies then? And I would invest in these companies because I've done a risk calculation of my money, and I believe the return is much higher than even Bitcoin in some of those companies, if they're successful. Some will fail. But the amount of money you can make by being successful and driving kind of a bet into some of these companies and then helping them achieve success is so staggering. I wouldn't want to say, but like you can just imagine betting on a technology company that actually helps people and drives a network effect and drive. And so I've been successful in a lot of those and constructing those in a way that that drives value. And some of that value is way in excess in what I would gain and have gained in Bitcoin. So that wouldn't change things at all. It might change it. And when I say change things at all, I got to be careful there, because in the short term, it would. Less money would be available for tech. Only the best projects would be funded, and you would move shorter. You would move out the 10, 20 year projects, and you would be looking for something shorter term. In the end, it wouldn't change things at all.
Okay.
It actually might accelerate things because that market, which would always put in hands of entrepreneurs and people and capital searching for a return, would be doing it out of their savings over time or investing in equity over time, that would be more in tune with our wants and desires, where that money should be.
As an investor now, Jeff, answer however you can. Are you already seeing and considering, for your own investment portfolio, that there's less long-term projects that interest you than there was a year ago?
Yeah, an entrepreneur said to me just recently that I've been coaching, not investing in her company, but I said last November, back up the truck and raise money now. Because a credit crisis is coming and you don't see it right now because everything's sunny, but a credit crisis is coming and capital is going to be really hard to get. And she said to me last week, she said, wow, our board didn't listen. I didn't listen. It was just, and now, and we still have a year of runway, but trying to raise money right now this is a good company trying to raise. So valuations have been just crushed. Because she needs more than a year runway. And so now somebody betting on that, which is actually probably a good bet in a type of company, is it just a totally different risk profile. And so absolutely, yes.
Okay. I'm going to start picking through some of these viewer questions. I have one big one that I'll save for maybe closer to the end. But I'll give you enough time to answer that.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier energy. Yeah, don't worry. I won't put you on the spot with like 3 minutes to go. Energy independence is big for Europe, Canada, United States. What we've seen in the last little while is this push for renewables. Sometimes it seems like against common sense. For example, I saw another story today about Germany continuing to close nuclear reactors in the face of what I think is almost a 100% jump expected in energy costs over there. Over the next year or so, I think it was March 2023, I saw. Anyway, not that that matters. Is there, in your view, a true path to a renewables-based future? Or are we really giving ourselves, are we really selling our soul to the devil with this kind of thing? What is your take on that?
My take is there is a path, and Bitcoin prices that path. It provides an economic incentive to chase stranded energy and low cost energy. Remember, Bitcoin mining, what people think is it can compete with retail customers of energy. There's no way if you're paying retail prices of energy in Bitcoin mining, then you're insolvent, right? So you have to chase lower cost energy. And let's just use an example of solar. Solar's not the only one or anything else, but let's use an example of solar. It only works when the sun's out, and then you have to build either battery storage or pump water up to a dam or something like that. And if you pump water to a dam to be able to be your battery, then it takes 40% more energy to be able to calculate that, which means if you want to build solar, you have to massively overbuild to protect when it's not sunny, protect the grid. Now, at some point, you could massively overbuild and run Bitcoin mining to be able to help price that, right? To be, you could, and so there is a path that's not really effective right now, but there is a path on energy independence that has to include Bitcoin, because it's the only way to drive the capital cost to overbuild in some of these things to give you a floor price of energy when you have to turn off the energy because it's overloading the grid. So, but where we are right now on coal plants turning back on and it's caused because if you have abundance in money, you have scarcity everywhere else. If you have scarcity in money, you have abundance everywhere else. So if you throw around, if you just make up 50% more monetary units, everything gets scarce. And so what I can't understand from all of the people, or not all of the people, a lot of people are starting to understand this, but the environmentalists, a fast way, if you care about the environment, a fast way to destroy the planet is to keep printing money, right? And I'm not just saying from what people are saying, CO2 or anything else, just environmentalism in general. You can't grow forever by manipulating money on a finite planet. It just goes against the laws of nature, goes against the laws of conservation yeah. of energy.
Yeah, it's really it's frustrating to listen to some of those debates with people. I think
By the way, Joey, the energy is going to be priced in Bitcoin. That transition is happening right now.
Yeah, I think you're right.
As energy giants, whether it starts at Bitcoin mining and energy is merging right now. It's really early in that, but you see Duke Energy doing a whole bunch of research in this. This is already known to many, many energy giants, and they're moving into when they're spending money on research and a bunch of this, a lot of that money in research is also public opinion research. So they know the answer. They know that it optimizes their business. And if they don't optimize their business, there's going to be another energy producer that makes far better returns and capture their business. So this is inevitable anyways. These things are going to merge, but it's just we're in the moment where it doesn't look inevitable.
The number of people we've had on from the mining space, Jeff, that have that viewpoint that energy and Bitcoin mining will become synonymous, and there'll be a really nice symbiotic relationship between the two in the next 10 years. You know, it's 1,000%. Every single guest says the same thing about that, and so now you're saying it as well. I think this is really going to turn a lot of people onto Bitcoin. I hope that it happens soon, but that remains to be seen. The other question I have for you here, I got a few more before we go into this big one, which I think you're going to like, by the way. Your friend Pierre Poilievre, I call him your friend. I don't know if he's your friend. You guys, as I understand it, have some kind of open dialogue. Again, you answer this however you like. If you can, great. If you can't, that's okay too. Where is he on Bitcoin as part of the Canadian economic picture? And maybe Bitcoin as part of the monetary mix in general? Does he have a strong view on that? I assume he's well informed. He's got guys like you, Foss, I think, as well, and maybe a few others speaking to him about this kind of stuff. Where is he on that? Does he have a view?
I don't want to speak for Pierre. He should speak for himself on this, and I think he has. He has a view that he's pro Bitcoin. He also has a view on what central bankers have done to the economy and what it does to society. And I think a lot of those and so he's had me in the House of Commons a couple times. He's invited me in the House of Commons on numerous occasions, trying to get the word out before things turned ugly like they are now about the risks the risks of our economic policy. And also, and I would say he also understands, I think more than anything else, he understands this, that when you manipulate money, then your government is designed through coercion instead of a free market. It has to lie to you. It has to coerce. It has to drive more control. And again, look at other countries that are in control of that. Look at Russia. Look at what that looks like. And what he realizes, if you want to live in an economic system that looks like that, then you're essentially voting for that coercion. And he understands, and I think he understands the risks of that. Now, again, like I said before, a different face on the problem. If the same thing has to happen, if a politician came in and just said, "I'm going to print all the money, and now it's going to be me who does it," and there is no plan to be able to transition your economy to something else, then to me that's somebody that's lying to you. And you could do you could do your own research on anything that I just said, and so. I would want to see a politician talk about what is the transition path.
Jeff, in the chat, people are asking what it's going to take for that politician to be you. I don't know. Do you want to answer that? You don't have to, but maybe give something to these guys.
And keep in mind, I there's no way in the world I would ever do that. And I and what I'd say for a lot of people that are listening then too is design flexibility into your life right now. If you have Bitcoin, you already have flexibility, but more so think about the truckers protests and what happened there. And you think about what actually almost had or could happen in any government in any time that change that based on coercion and laws changing to protect the coercion. It's a frightening prospect, and it's a frightening prospect in many regions of the world today. And so make sure you design flexibility to be able to move jurisdictions if you need to. I hate to say that. Canada is actually pretty resilient in what we're doing because we do have energy independence. We do have food independence. And so in fact, the more that people print money, Canada doesn't fall by the same amount because of our natural resources. So we're actually one of the beneficiaries of that printing money, and it gives us more flexibility. It still hurts our citizens, or a lot of our citizens that kind of, especially the middle class and poor, they get killed through that process. But and that kind of loss of faith in what ends up happening essentially changes government structure because they vote to take back everything. Retain flexibility in your life today.
Yeah, that's good advice. We've heard that a bunch from a lot of smart people over the years. Here's the big one for you, Jeff. Before I get into one more with a little bit of a humorous spin, and then of course I got to give you some gripe in your personal life before I let you go. Here's the question. For a long time, Bitcoiners have been speaking about the state using natural technological deflation to hide real base money inflation and keep the money printing scheme going to benefit cantillionaires. Now there appears to be a theory about controlled demolition of infrastructure, which, if true, would be designed to cause price inflation. Is that just circumstantial, or in your opinion, do you think that these are real forces? And if so, how would you explain the two competing narratives? Because they would seem to purposely drive price in opposite directions. Like I said, big question.
Yeah. So you know, I said this on a podcast yesterday. Money is just information, right? And money is information. You don't actually want more money. You want what you think more money will buy you, right? And so it's a ledger of what you think you have and what you believe you need to be able to get more. And so that when you have misinformation and money, you grant an authority to essentially create more misinformation and money. And then now just let's say now you automate it through technology, social media and the like, then you have misinformation everywhere in society. and you must have, right? It's just information, and you've now created misinformation in society, and it explodes. And so what's happening today is everybody's looking through that misinformation, and conspiracy theorists reign in that. But it's largely, and there's some really evil people in the world. Predominantly, it's just a system feeding back on itself. Even if you just said this, Klaus Schwab, right? Who you might just put up as Dr. Evil. even if you said Klaus Schwab and cronies there, let's just imagine in a free market, and I think this is probably more what's realistic if you look at his Great Reset book and everything else. You have somebody who came up with an idea, said maybe the same idea that I had, right? Technology is exponentially deflationary. It's going to remove eventually most jobs or the majority of jobs. And what do we do? And on one side of that, you could say, us really smart people, and we were only privileged to be able to put in this spot because of the inflationary monetary policy in the first place. And now we went to all the best schools and everything else, and so we're in this elite spot. We better look after those stupid people, because they're not going to be able to take care of themselves. And you could easily delude yourself into that belief, and you could convince a whole bunch of other people that that's what you had to do to protect society. And they might actually believe it. The worst thing is, it might actually be they believe that they have to. They're put on this planet to be able to save, and unaware that they're actually concentrating all of control into a control structure that cannot work. So CBDCs cannot work. We can explore that a little bit as well, but they might actually believe it, which is worse, right? So they might actually think that they're doing good for society when in fact they're doing the worst thing possible versus me, who just had a different idea. Mm-hmm. Let prices fall, right? Let prices do the natural thing. And the broad-based abundance that would be gained through technology is supposed to free our time. And the free market is the best way to let the abundance from that technology gain distribute to society. So two different ideas. One idea, centrally controlled structure. Mm-hmm. One idea, free market structure. That are now competing. And Bitcoin, and the reason why it's also inevitable is it's a free market structure. It is us. It is our ideas moving, getting stronger and stronger. And why the protocol just keeps on getting stronger and moving faster and faster, regardless of the price. So there's a whole bunch of people that are pricing Bitcoin from the existing system when it will price everything. They don't realize that eventually Bitcoin's going to price the existing system, everything.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people still measure in dollars, and I'm guilty of that as well. I mean, geez, we start every show talking about what the price is in U.S. dollars. Maybe we should stop that. I'll tell Lynn next time I see him.
Because it just now look backwards, because of the lag effects of money printing or tightening can't be seen. Remember when money printing happened and all the central banks around the world said there's going to be a no inflation or inflation, and then inflation's transitory, and then, oh my God, so that's the lag effects of what's happening. And now they're tightening, and everybody is saying, oh, it's going to be okay, that there's not going to be mass unemployment. Wait till you see the lag effects of the tightening. And so through that lens, what you realize is Bitcoin, once you price that lag effects, so if they kept tightening, Bitcoin would be the only thing of any value, because you can peer-to-peer trade it around the world. Because otherwise, the only thing of value would be the cash you have under your mattress, because the banks would close, right? So Bitcoin would be the only thing of any value in the tightening model. They're going to ease again in Bitcoin. But what in Bitcoin is going to rise crazy, but what it's really doing is pricing all of that nonsense, whether there's capital destruction, right? or capital destruction through inflation, it's pricing that transition. Eventually, it's, as Knut would say, it's everything divided by 21 million.
Yeah, I like that meme a lot. I hope people adopt that and start thinking about that a little more. Jeff, I got to ask you about this fur trappers, beaver trapping. What in God's name are you doing over there? I heard Ben was talking about this on Sessions maybe like 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I was at the gym. I had to stop what I was doing and rewind. Are you, you've acquired some kind of very difficult to get certification that you're using for some other purpose. Do you want to talk about that? Do you mind? what's going on there?
Stupid things that stupid things that I do for 200, Alex. So obviously Canada's founding and fur trading used to be a really big deal as Canada expanded, and there's this federal law that you can buy rights to lands. And a lot of land, if you're a trapper, if you're a fur trader, and so some buddies and I kind of found this, and we realized, wow, there's an arbitrage of value too, because nobody's trapping anymore, and so all of these rights to land are for sale, and it's not, you don't own the land, you own the rights to the land, but it allows you to build up to 6 homes on the land and such too. So we all went and took our trapper's license and then we bought a piece of land, 2,500 square miles. So a little piece of land, and the 2,500 square miles was $25,000. And so we helicoptered in, all the building materials for some cabins. And so now we have, after this weekend, we'll have 2 cabins on the on a lake in the middle of it's fantastic.
What is the hardest question on the trapper's license exam? What are they even asking you? No one knows anything about this.
Yeah, so no one knows anything about this. But if you you could go in and take that, you have to spend 3 days in an in class to be able to do this, and you have to.
You have to spend 3 days in the wilderness trapping.
No, but you do have to learn to trap and such as well. Quick thing there. I remember on the third day, our trainer said, and you remember, you've gone through this, and he takes out this beaver pelt that's on the wall and it's pegged to the wall. And all I'm doing is he's unpegging it. I'm going through the what it took for him to do this. So first he went out to his land and he bought traps. He went out to land, set traps, came out, went back whenever, a week later, got this beaver, then brought it back, skinned it, everything else, pegged it up to this board for a month. And so all of that work and everything else. And then he unpegs this and super proud, he says this, "There's your $20. and right there I realized, that's why nobody does this.
That's right. I like that. There's people in the chat now saying we should do the course. Maybe I will. I didn't realize it was that cheap. 25K, you know, if a bunch of us get together, I don't know, I might need to take a loan from you, Jeff, to helicopter the supplies in, but I'll at least buy the rights to the land. I got to think about that. I wouldn't mind getting a nice trapping license or something in my free time. You've been an outstanding guest, sir. I appreciate you doing the show. I know you're traveling a lot. You and I both had some adversity to overcome here with this Rogers outage. I don't know what the hell's going on there, but I can't let you go without asking you one more question. We ask this to a lot of our guests at the end of the program. If you are in a parking lot, Jeff, okay, I don't know where you do your grocery shopping, but let's say it's a nice asphalt open space, okay, and you're there standing in the parking lot in your best pair of running shoes, shorts, t-shirt, whatever. Maybe you pop in the tarp. I don't know. Maybe you're like absolutely ripped and you want to show it off. It's up to you, buddy. You decide. But next to you is your buddy Preston Pish, and he's in the same gear, okay? And 40 yards away on that asphalt jungle, there's a checkered flag. Okay, a finish line. Can you beat Preston Pish in a 40-yard foot race? And if you can, how much are you beating him by?
Oh, good question. I'm going to say the competitive spirit in me would say yes.
But
I don't know. Preston's in pretty good shape.
Listen, well, I'm going to tell him he's got to come on the show to defend his honor here, and he can give his own answer. Jeff, where can people find you? What are you working on now? Whatever you want, it's all yours, man. Give the handoff.
Just best is probably on Twitter at Jeff Booth on Twitter. I think you know I started co-founded Ego Death Capital along with Andy and Nico. That is wildly exciting. And wildly exciting because it's a Bitcoin only ecosystem fund that's investing in Bitcoin only or Bitcoin second layer, third layer companies. And if people realized what was actually coming, not what's here now, what's coming and what's and how fast this ecosystem is going to be developed, they'd get really excited. It's like the dawn of the internet. Bitcoin is exactly like the dawn of the internet. And I cannot believe I get to have a chance to work with all of these amazing, brilliant people in this space. It's so much fun.
They're great. I should mention Andy and Nico just went on the Carrazza show, Your Life, Your Terms, not long ago. So they're friends of ours. Jeff, definitely check that out. If you're listening to this program, you're going to enjoy that interview with the other founders of Ego Death. That's it, Jeff Booth. Thank you again, my friend. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Roy.
No worries. Great. Well done.